Hello, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of the Upria podcast. I am your guest, as always, Horatio. Today I'm by myself, but I think the topic is interesting enough that we may not need a guest for today. But it would be pretty cool one day to have like a historian, like an actual historian, come on the show and talk about any a topic like the one I'm going to talk about today, because I am no historian. Let me make that very clear, but I am an enthusiast. I like history. So, as it so happens to be, a lot of times I noticed this that if I am like engaging into one certain historical theme, it finds itself in a lot of different avenues. So, for example, if I am reading a book on Roman history, well, then it turns out that I'm like interested in a show about ancient Rome, or I'm watching a documentary on ancient Rome, or I'm like, or there's a movie on like suddenly on Netflix or something about it, and I just end up watching it, or I listen to an audiobook or something like that. It happens to be that lately, this sort of the Middle Ages into the early Renaissance period has been sort of piquing my interest, and I've been getting into that. I've been reading a couple of books. I've been listening to a couple of audiobooks. I've been watching a couple of movies on the period. I've been, you know, reading Dante again, which is always great. And I'm listening, and it just so happens to be that I was listening to Dan Carlin's podcast, his newest one on capital punishment and how they used to carry it out during this, like during that specific time. And I don't know, it just seems like I've been getting a taste of that era from multiple avenues, and I kind of want to talk about it. I kind of want to talk about it a little bit, because to me, one of the most interesting quotes that I've ever read when I was younger, and it really started to move me into this specific kind of philosophical thinking, which is like historical philosophical thinking. It is hermeneutic. It's about understanding the people and what they believe and the forces that act upon them. That is how we come to understand what knowledge is. And I know it's kind of a controversial thing, and it's not really in vogue nowadays, because, you know, the analytic side of philosophy wants to say that truth is truth and nothing but the truth, and if we can figure it out through language, through logic, or through some other inductive means, there is no reason to appeal to human opinion or human custom or culture or tradition, because that muddies the water. And my response has always been, well, of course, because that's the truth under which these people operate. That's the truth under which everyday people operate. Most human beings don't work under the assumption that their truths are apodictic, that they're absolutely and fundamentally valid. They don't. We work under the system of, well, this is what my family taught me. This is what my surrounding society finds to be true, what finds to be false. And I think that's a little bit more interesting than trying to find these ahistorical apodictic truths. Now, that's not to say that it's a pure relativism, because on the other side, although I sort of am more, I am more interested in this historical development of what people believe, I have a sort of transcendental intimation, or you know, an intuition that the ways that people actually exist is not so random, that there are certain structures that shape the way we actually are, and if we can sort of find those structures, then we can find the structures of any kind of human being. And here I mean literally human being, the being of humans. But that's a bridge too far. So anyway, so again, so this is why I'm always interested in trying to figure out what kind of values, what kind of beliefs that actual historical people are living under. And it just happens to be that it's kind of alien to me, because I don't live in that world anymore, how people used to live under the paradigm of Christianity or Christendom or the Islamic world back in the day, like this old, you know, before the Enlightenment period, before modernism, this sort of idea that the world is actually governed by this sort of overarching God, and it influences every single aspect of life. There is no separation of church and state. There is no separation of church and anything. And anything, really think about it, church and state, there's no separation there. There's no separation between church and art, right? All of these, most of the art that survived the period that we have is of religious nature, right? They're either sculptures of Christ, paintings of scenes in the Bible. There's not a lot else. There's not, you know, so art, music, right? Some of the greatest and most important developments in music came about because they were starting to implement music in churches, right? Or singing or the choir or something like that. So there was no separation at all between church and anything. And that's why, going all the way back now to what I originally say, there is a quote in William Barrett's Irrational Man that it has always stuck with me, because I think it's important. And it's that we can never understand the world of Dante Alighieri. There is no one who is possible, there's no one possible alive today who could ever write something like the Inferno. We just don't have that paradigm anymore. We don't have the paradigm that our actions, that our finite actions that we think, you know, just happens here where we live, have eternal ramifications, and that there is this sort of universal karma. We sort of still have this idea of karma, but it's not like this eternal universal karma. Our actions don't get inverse or reversed to punish us, to spite us at the end of the day. We just don't have that. And moreover, we don't have the world of mythology anymore, right? Because if you read Dante, if you read the Inferno, you quickly realize it's not just like Christian mythology, if you want to call it that, but there's like Greek and Roman and like all these other, you know, secondary characters who, you know, play a huge role in the text and played a huge role in these people's lives. And that's gone. And this idea, I you know, all throughout, you know, I'm reading a book on the Reformation, right? Reformation is this huge, just massive undertaking, right? Most people attribute it to Luther, but it's not just Luther. You've had all these different kinds of pastors, you know, bucking the status quo and, you know, fighting against establishment, because ultimately that's it. That's one of the main and central themes of the Reformation, is why should we trust our salvation? Because again, that's the central question. Why should we trust our eternal salvation to this bureaucracy and institution in Italy? Like, we're Germans, or we're Swiss, or we're from Norway, whatever. Why should we, you know, why should we trust our eternal lives to these people down south? And so, and this was an existential question. This was not just a question of affiliation. The more I hear and the more I read, this is the paradigm under which these people live. And I know this is like not, you know, groundbreaking thoughts that I'm having, but it still fascinates me. Like this idea of living under a paradigm, and living under a paradigm that is so remote to me, that is so far beyond me and my comprehension, that it's kind of hard, but not really to. No, it is. I'm be honest. It's kind of hard for me to relate, because a lot of things I just don't understand. So going to the Dan Carlin podcast, there are some moments in there where I'm just left, you know, speechless. The idea that in these executions that the person who was about to die needed to sort of perform a gesture of atonement, needed, not just like, oh, it's good that this person is like repenting. No, they needed to put on a good gesture of repentance and atonement, and that the audience needed to give a gesture of forgiveness. That there was this sort of symbiotic relationship between the audience and the condemned. That if they showed enough, repentance and forgiveness, this pushing and pulling, that maybe the condemned can actually be forgiven. Maybe their sins will be a wash, God will wash their sins away. And that, execution is a good thing. It reminds me of Plato, right? It reminds me of Plato. Plato said, I forget which text it is, but he basically, like, a son has to, like, condemn his father or something like that, or a father has to condemn his son. I forget which one it goes. And in that text, Socrates basically says, it's a good thing to punish people because we're helping them. We're healing them. There was something wrong with them that they committed these criminal acts. There was something already wrong with them. And to restore them to society is to punish them, to make them say, you have paid your debts. And this will make you, a healthy, quote unquote, healthy person. But, to me, I don't understand how killing a person, right? How killing you will restore you to justice, right? That's why I'm sort of against capital punishment, because I don't see how the ending of one life remedies or mollifies anything besides this sort of symbolic act, right? It doesn't actually fix anything. But it seemed like these people living in the Middle Ages and the early Renaissance period, like, they took this very seriously. And not only was it like a sort of healing process between the culprit and the surrounding society, right? That's sort of what Plato was talking about. But now there's like this added layer that the healing process is between you, your surrounding society, and God. And now you have this extra pressure, and it's like, hey, you can't really be like, hey, just, okay, fine, kill me. No, because you yourself are believing that you're going to be eternally condemned in life, and now you're going to be eternally condemned in death. So you need to put on like a good show your atonement, like cry and plead forgiveness for Jesus. And the weird thing is, like, the more you did that, the more the crowd would sympathize with you. And they would, like, beg the executioner not to kill him. Or they would beg the executioner to do it quickly, or, do it rightly so you won't suffer or something like this, right? It was a weird dynamic. And it's all because these people were working under this sort of religious paradigm of restoration, of criminal restoration, of justice. It's not only at the social level, but it's like this universal level that these people were working under. And again, you see that in Dante, right? This idea of restoring justice, the punishments you receive in hell is restoring this balance in the universe that you've done. And the only way to do it is sort of to take your actions and inverse them as a punishment towards you. There is another thing that I wanted to talk about, which this text on the Reformation that I referenced to has been a good little, refresher, because I used to, I took a lot of history courses and I never actually majored. I almost majored, but, I took an entire semester to study Martin Luther, because I thought it was an interesting figure. And, you know, from the little that I had known from him before, right, he was always painted as this horrible guy, as this horrible guy who brought, like, a lot of, you know, basically split up Europe. And, you know, was this sort of anti-Semite, you know, poison-tongued pastor. But again, he's like, after coming out of the class, you sort of understand him a little bit more. And how, again, like, everyone at that time was sort of ready for this. They were very, very ready for this. It's not even just like in Germany or like in northern Europe. It was all these events everywhere, right? So even a little bit later on, you would have these outbreaks, these revolutions, or little riots happening in all these different little towns. So, you know, the big break happened, and then you have like people like Savonarola and like Florence, right? You have this crazy mystic priest convincing people that the end was coming soon, and that they should like destroy all the art because it was like corrupting their soul and like kicking out all the government officials until, you know, he was put to death and they burned him alive. You have all these outbreaks in all these places in Europe of these pastors convincing a town or two to revolt against their feudal lords. And this sort of happened with Martin Luther as well in the Peasant Revolt. Because once you start revolting against the church, right, against one institution, then you start to question, well, why don't we start revolting against every institution? And I think Hegel sort of had this idea, right? Once you achieve freedom, once you break the bonds of one institution, then all the bonds of any institution are free to go. Because again, his whole idea is that you come to the realization that institutions are man-made, that they can be broken apart, that you can't get away from them. They're not divine. They're not divinely ordained. If you can break away from the Catholic Church, which for 1,500 years, 1,200 years, it was saying it was the institution of God. It was saying that. And you had history and tradition, and you can make a lineage all the way to Peter, and these people broke away from that lineage. They were like, we're done, we're not gonna be a part of this, we're gonna do our own thing. Because they came to the realization, not consciously, right? They might not have actually said this, but I think Hegel is aware what happens when you break away from an institution, when you say this institution no longer applies to me, because you're just man-made. You're just a human artifact. You're not actually, you know, decreed by God. So in the Peasants' Revolution, they started revolting against those lords who weren't allowing them to worship in the way that they wanted to, right? Or they were revolting against like certain taxations. And here, Martin Luther sort of stabbed him in the back, per se. Right? So you have this figure who is leading the Reformation, who is the central figure of, you know, upending the connection to one institution, pulling back and siding with another institution. He sided with the nobles. You know, Martin Luther chastised the people who were revolting. And again, and this is the moment where he gets, you know, his horrendous reputation, which is well deserved. I think it's well deserved, and this is not an excuse. I'm not trying to excuse him. I'm trying to explain what he said. So his whole idea is that there is no greater evil. And I think, you know, Hegel sort of inherited this from Martin Luther. there is no greater evil than groups of humanity without institutions, because it's just anarchy. If people are not living through this structured way of being, if you don't set up institutions for them, then it just becomes anarchy, and it just engenders violence and thievery and rape and burning and looting and all these horrendous aspects that we try to, that we believe that civilization and society forming together into society is supposed to abate, right? It's supposed to end this stuff. So Martin Luther sort of, he sided with the nobles. He was like, no, you guys need to stop this, right? I think he was aware of the dangers of going for a free-for-all. So in a sense, there was a spiritual revolution, but there, at the level of the state, that revolution never happened. Because the state always remained, and it actually got more powerful. You know, all these like different little principalities in Germany started like coalescing, having great force. It didn't go the other way around. So again, we started to see that in the Middle Ages, all these people were functioning under this one paradigm, right? Under the paradigm of Catholic Christianity, and that's how it began. But then there was some sort of revolution to say, well, that this institution is foreign. It speaks a different language than me. Let's do it for ourselves. Let's separate. Let's start printing the Bible in our language. Let's start having the sermons in our language. Let's start doing this in our language, and start doing things our way. And I think at this moment, right, as soon as you break away from the Catholic Church, which means you can break away from any institution, you know, the key to break away from anything is there. It's a possibility. And you see this, right? You see that with these Protestants and all these Protestant groups, they start splitting off. They start breaking off from one each other because of sort of theological disputes. And they start going their own way, right? You know, the Pilgrims, they split off from the Anglicans. They couldn't take it anymore, and they split off. But there, I think Nietzsche is helpful here, because I think this is what he means when God is dead. You know, Nietzsche's not making a metaphysical statement here. He's not saying, that there was never a God. Or he's saying that we actually like murdered God, like he was here, but he's not here any longer. What he's saying is that the values, the beliefs, and the truths that society, that held society together for the longest time, no longer has the force to do it. There needs to be another component here that is a cohesive paradigm, and under which people will place themselves so that they can receive values from above or from another, right? And this is all spiel, right? Because again, the overman or the superman is the person who can give themselves their own values. So my guess is that Nietzsche, if he was around, let's say 50 more years, he would have seen this process with the rise of nationalism, which was already happening in his time, right? He lived in Prussia through the coalescing of Prussia and through the German kingdom, the German Empire. So he was already seeing this, but I think Nietzsche would have freaked out with the world wars, right? Because nationalism was running amok. And sometimes I see those, I read the accounts of World War I and World War II when they are at their most fever pitched, at their most propagandistic, and they don't seem that difficult from the wars of religion that we saw before. Now, instead of fighting for God or fighting for the right beliefs, you're fighting for the state. You're fighting for your your king, or you're fighting for your land. So I kind of want to end today's podcast with a question. Under what paradigm are we working under? Under what values are we being influenced? And I think this is a really hard question, right? Because we don't have the historical distance so that we can judge what's happened or occurred. We don't have that right now. And it's always harder to sort of determine it in the moment, in the muck, in the mud. And a tantalizing question, and one that, you know, Habermas sort of alluded to, is that we may not be working under a paradigm anymore. There is no more overarching system giving us these values. Instead, we have to sort of media-driven, political, all these sort of splintered values, right? So, right, we have values based on like our politics or in our religious group, and like the movies that we see, the music that we listen to, the friends that we hang out. But there's no more like overarching thing anymore. I don't feel that there is. For example, when I think about the state, right, I don't get a sense of any kind of direction. The country is not going in any direction. It has no goals. It has no end. It has nothing. And usually the way sort of states get away with this is they start a war, right? Or there's a gigantic crisis or catastrophe, and like it directs all the efforts to solve these issues, and the conversation ends, or it tries to avoid the conversation by what Habermas would say is creating a welfare state, in where, or a industrial military complex, where the efforts of the state is to address these sort of technical questions, right? How do we make better airplanes so that we can say that we're protecting our people? Or how can we implement these social programs, and how can we make them better? And then we can play around with saying, oh, well, let's take away the social programs and make them worse. And it's just a game. So the discussion is sort of in the weeds, but there's no telos, there's no end in sight. There's no direction. Everyone is pushing and pulling toward their own interests. And the problem that we see in our society today is that there are corporations or groups of certain people who have a lot of money. They're able to shift the direction their way and get their, agenda on the table and get their agenda passed. So it's absolutely, I see the paradigm that we're under as absolutely fractured into a million interests. Thousands and thousands of interests. So unlike before, where they were sort of like unitary, you know, most people, you know, they wanted like eternal life. And they lived under this paradigm of wanting to live forever because of their beliefs. That's not in the conversation anymore. Sure, there are, you know, there are some like really annoying fundamental religious people out there who are doing exactly what everyone else is doing. They're accumulating and grouping into this interest group and then directing the nation toward their beliefs. But that's sort of alienated, because it feels very alienating, because again, the majority of the people don't actually have these views. So only because like 20% of these people have these views, it doesn't mean that everyone else has them. And that's the sort of annoying aspect of it, right? Or when like the NRA has their agenda and it pulls the country to one direction, it's annoying to you, right? It's like, oh my God, really? Why are we wasting our time with this? So it's a pushing and pulling of all these different interest groups where there is, and I don't think there is anyone. And this is a frightening thing. And I think it's a terrifying thing because it doesn't eliminate the possibility of the fact that there could be another paradigm. So the frightening thing is that we don't know what might replace it. It might not be the state anymore. The state, maybe we lost faith in the state after the world wars. We saw that these, you know, giving our lives for the state isn't a good idea. And I think that's great. I think that's right. But what comes after? What comes after? I think that's the interesting question here. What is? Because I don't think human beings have changed so much that we are not susceptible of this, you know, appropriating of values. So I wonder what comes next. Perhaps a tantalizing response could be technology, right? We start putting our faith in technology, and you're sort of starting to hear a little rumblings of this. Maybe it's because, you know, I'm like in my own bubble, so I'm on like Reddit all the time, and I'm on the internet all the time, so I'm starting to see this like Elon Musk, SpaceX, Tesla hero worship, and it's like, oh, okay, maybe these people will start falling onto the paradigm, and you see it in philosophy as well, onto the paradigm that we need to move on from humanity. So post-humanism, I think that's another possibility, that we come to the paradigm that ends us, that ends humanity as it is, and then we become something else. But that something else, I don't think would have values, right? Do machines have values? They might. I don't know. I don't know. Anyways, I'll leave you with that. I'll leave you with that discussion. I hope this has been clear, but for the most part, I just wanted to, you know, just express some of the thoughts I've been having, which is always good. I think it's a good idea to throw out your ideas sometimes, because I feel like some people only speak or actually place themselves in an open forum when their ideas are written to a T, right? When they're absolutely exact. I'm kind of doing a weird thing that in the back of my head, I'm mostly like checking myself for like logical fallacies and where my thinking has gone wrong or how I could correct myself later on. So I don't know. I think we will try this once more. I'll just pick a topic and I'll just start talking about it. And then I'll try to talk about another topic in a more deliberate way. So I hope everyone has enjoyed this episode. If you want to contact us or to reach out or just say something, ask a question, recommend a topic, please go to the Operia Podcast on Twitter. The actual address is at Operia Podcast on Twitter. At Operia Podcast on Twitter, one word. Follow us there. I just opened it up. There's not a lot of action there, but I think I'll start posting some philosophy quotes and philosophy pictures there and giving you guys news and updates on what's going on. So, yeah, hope everyone enjoyed this episode, and I guess I'll see you next week. Take care.